I'm Gene, and this is Perfect Flow. I'm a New Zealand-based athlete and coach focused on optimizing performance, health, and well-being. While I have a professional background in biomedical engineering, I've chosen to follow my more immediate passions for running, endurance, adventure, movement, nutrition, lifestyle, community, psychology, and personal growth. My goal in starting this podcast is to connect with bright minds to extract the information I need to live a life that makes sense and feels good, and share those conversations with others. Apart from your favorite podcast app, the best places to follow my work are perfectflow.nz, genebeverage.nz, and Perfect Flow on Facebook. What's up, guys? Hope you're all well. So today's podcast is Sia Svensson, and anyone who has met Sia, I think, will understand why I don't really have a great way of describing this conversation. Her life story is intense. It's pretty overwhelming, really. And the best way to wrap your head around it is really just to get straight into it. So I won't dawdle here for too long. But the reasons I sought out Sia to sit down with her was, of course, my interest in mental health and well-being. And I think we can learn the most from those who have struggled the most. And her story is certainly not easy, but it's fantastic that she's in a good place now in Christchurch and still very active, still a very strong athlete, and just enjoying everything that New Zealand has to offer in that regard. The one apology I have to make is for the sound quality. I didn't do this with the headphones on, so I didn't have the feedback to hear that her mic was kind of been overdriven, and it's clipping, so the sound quality on her side isn't great. Just sitting there. Anyone who knows anything about recording will probably think I'm a complete munter, but in my defense, one of my mics seems to clip at a level much lower than the other sometimes. So it seems to be a software issue, seems to be a driver issue, and yeah, it normally runs smoothly, but I get some confidence and decided not to use the headphones, and it decided to start clipping at a level much lower than what the other's clipping. So it doesn't look bad looking at the scope from a distance, but listening to it, you can hear there's a bit of distortion. So I think you get used to it. Once you've listened for a few minutes, I think your ears kind of dial in a little bit. But anyway, it's not worth missing just because the audio is not great. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. It's really quite outstanding, and I think it's a very inspirational story. So I bring you Sia Svensson. Sia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
And thank you for welcoming me into your house. It's quite a cool setup here at the moment. How do you feel that this current little batch, Simple Life, is doing for you at the moment?
Yes, it's quite a... We have lived here for the last 4 months. Previously, we lived in Sumner, also in one-bedroom apartment more so. But we have a dream about building our own recycled tiny house. Yeah. So this is a good opportunity for us to live more basic. And this batch, we call it, or hot... Mm-hmm. is built out of people who lived here and built tiny houses. So each couple who have lived here have contributed to building a little piece on this batch. So nothing is quite maybe in alignment, but it has a lot of history. And for us, it's a really good way to try and live a little bit more basic or minimalistic to really figure out what matters more in life.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are on the same buzz, actually. There's a lot of people who are finding their previous years a little bit intense and are looking for their future years to maybe be a little more simple and a little more quiet. I think I'm definitely noticing the same. I've come from working full-time and trying to be a full-time athlete while working to now just working from home, but most of the time I'm relaxing and doing more yoga and meditation and
cooking and just spending time doing more basic things. And yeah, it's definitely been interesting. And it feels, as soon as I miss a few nights sleep and get a little bit stressed, it's really obvious now, because I've experienced what it's like to be relaxed all the time. It's hard to go back, isn't it, once you find things a little easier?
Yeah, I just said that to a few friends last night. I think it would feel hard to move back into maybe a big house with a lot of rooms, maybe from the outside more perfect modern house. But I think a bit like you said yourself, I've made some choices in the last 6 months in my life about quitting my job of 8 years because of a few things I wanted to pursue in life. And then my partner and I discussed our circumstances had to change the way we live. So we enjoy having a low expense living. And it's really fulfilled me in other ways that I could pursue my passion for movement, which is also part of the way we live. So we don't have chairs, for example. So it's a good extension of trying to follow your dreams a little bit and giving it a go. And sometimes things have to adjust. So it's, as you say, just like enjoying more things about cooking. We go to community organic gardens to pick free food, and what can we make with that food in the season. So it's been really nourishing in a different way. And
yeah, well, it's amazing to see that you've got here, but you didn't take a straight route to this place in your life. I'd be keen to go back a little bit, and I'm not sure how comfortable you are talking about everything from a younger age, but I'll let you decide what you want to talk about and what you don't. But I'd be personally really interested to hear about your childhood growing up on some little island somewhere between Denmark and Sweden. Is that right?
Yes, it's a little island called Bornholm. So it's in the Baltic Sea. So it's actually closer to Sweden. I'm not quite entirely sure why it belongs to Denmark. I think it should probably more belong to Sweden.
Because of some war ages ago, probably.
Yeah, always some war history. But it's a very famous for a lot of cool things going on. So I was born there and lived there till I was 17 years old. So my parents split at an early age when I was 4 and my brother was not even 1. My dad got the custody of us at the time because my mum and dad had us fairly young, or young in today's age, around, they were about 20 years old. So at the time it was best for my dad to get custody. And my dad is an engineer and he took over a farm. So I grew up on a country farm on the island. The island is only quite small, 40,000 people. If you were to cycle around, it's about 100K. So it's fairly small. And so we had to bike to school, country school, bike home. I had horses from a young age. Growing up was a huge challenge. And I think it's only later on in life, when we maybe adults or late teenagers, we reflect on what happens to us and maybe how it shapes us later on as adults. And growing up was tough. Like I loved my dad and I always looked up to him. He's very athletic. I never thought he looked anything like me, except he had really curly hair, but he was quite fairly tall, very athletic, very, very fit, just walking around on the farm, took me out horse riding. But he was very busy because he was the only one on the farm. His parents, so my grandparents, were also quite active, and I had a really good nourishing relationship with them. And my grandma from my dad's side always helped me a lot with home cooking and stuff. My dad got a new partner, and we had a different relationship that involved in emotional stress for me in particular. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that as 10 years old, I stopped eating. Okay. I didn't know anything about eating disorders, and I didn't have an eating disorder, but I didn't cope with the situation at home. There was a lot of friction, not much attention from my dad. It was really tough the way our situation was with the situation with my stepmom. And it resulted in a lot of more, some people would probably call it emotional tension or abuse. And so, yeah, I stopped eating and I was down to 18 kilos. Wow. as a 10-year-old, which it started to made me look like more like in a concentration camp. Yeah. And I think if people have seen particularly teenagers suffering from eating disorders, you get really gaunt looking, you can count every ribs. And it was only when I fainted at home, my dad got me to the hospital. And I just had no idea what was happening to me as a child. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, I remember my classmates came to me in the hospital, I had drips, I hadn't been really to the toilet for days. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, the doctor's just going to give me an injection and I will be all fine again. I don't know what's going on with me. And my dad was awfully worried, but he never really said anything. So our relationship had involved that we didn't really talk much. And I didn't realize that as so young, we don't have the words to explain how we feel. So it's when we get adults, maybe some of us get better of explaining yeah. that I'm actually not doing so well now. So I didn't understand that growing up, and I've talked a little bit with Andrea Murray, or Andrea Davis now, so Keith Murray's ex-wife, and it was really interesting to see, hear more from other people how for girls or daughters, how their relationship with their dad is quite important early on in life. Mm-hmm. So it turned out that I was that bad that they had to transport me to the main hospital in Copenhagen. So I got flown over there, got put in a special child's psychiatric department.
Really? Oh, man.
And at that time, it was back, I can't even quite count now, but I was 10 years old and I'm 42 now. Mm-hmm. So it was a system that no longer operates because our view of treating people with, whether it's depression or eating disorders, is a lot more caring and nurturing environment, not this punish and reward system. Yeah. So I was put in basically a prison. We were 7 kids in each department with locked doors, locked windows, a bed, and you were allowed to only go out when the doctors and nurses allowed you to go out. And you had a little hall where everything was gardened off, so we could just do a bit of movement out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was put in with kids, anything from 10. I was one of the youngest that they didn't really know what I was suffering from.
Mm-hmm.
They diagnosed me with anorexia, but they soon found out it came more from lack of love from my family. And I reacted in the way I stopped eating. So I think having grown older, I see that often in maybe females, but also more males now, that when we don't know what to do, we do something that we can control. And that's often exercise, ridiculous, or we stop eating and we feel in control, even though we don't know maybe the consequences at the time.
Yep. And at the time for you, did you feel like you were consciously avoiding food or there was just no desire?
I had actually no idea what I was doing. I just... So maybe we maybe need more psychology to but I think it was just a way for me unconsciously feel in control. And I remember my dad was obviously getting worried, you know, trying to stuff food down my throat and getting really angry. You know, there was a lot of aggressive outbursts.
Because, as opposed to supporting you, it was more like trying to push you in the into the right direction.
Yeah.
And how did you move on from that period of your life?
So I turned out I was in the hospital for 1 year. So it was hugely expensive. I wouldn't even have thought about the cost to be in a department like that. And I was with kids that were suffering bipolar. So, you know, all of a sudden things could be flying through the hallway or the rooms. I was also with a lot of teenage girls that are suffering anorexia. So I picked up a lot of tricks for them that I had no idea what tricks were, but I was so young. I was the youngest one there that was diagnosed with anorexia. So it was really, I just remember you had to go to school for 1 hour a day. I just remember saying to my school teacher, I don't really know why I'm in here. And I just try and imitate what the other girls do. And so we had quite a fun conversation about that, because those girls, it was really interesting now looking back on, because eating for them is such a struggle that, you know, some of them could sit trying to eat something and it could, you know, nurses and doctors would sit with them for like an hour until they had to eat it. If they didn't eat it, they would even get fit through their nose, or it would have some punishment treatment. So it was really interesting now looking back, even though when we get older, it's sort of, we forget every stages what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds like just a totally different world. And I'm glad we've moved on from treating people like that. At least largely, we're understanding the importance of love and social connections in dealing with these issues at more of a root cause than just trying to push back the symptom, push back the thing that's most obvious. So how did you get through your youth, and when did the outdoor sports kind of come into the picture for you?
Yeah, so I've always been very active. I said both my mum and dad very active, my brother too. So while all this was going on and before, I was always very involved in obviously biking to school. It was about 10Ks. Working around the farm, I played a lot of handball. It's a very popular sport. So that was my thing. Going to gymnastics. I never really run as such, and so when I came out of the hospitals, we tried to get things working. It was really difficult. Obviously, I'd lost a year of schooling. I was still recovering because I'd lost so much strength that I had to try and build up strength, and doctors wasn't really sure whether I had done much damage to my brain or to my heart, they said. But I've always been quite a fighter. So back then, especially as a kid, I don't really know in which sense I was fighting, but I remember riding my horse and I was like, I will get through this. But there was still the lack of attention from home, the lack of attention from my stepmom as a sense of love. You know, they would go on holidays with my dad and leave us at home. So it was quite lonely, but I had really good classmates, and it's really interesting for me seeing now, if I put something on Facebook, that people that followed me when I was sick and when I was struggling, they click, and I might not ever see them again, but from that island, they still have that connection with me, and they go, oh, see, she's doing her thing in New Zealand. So that keeps me a little bit strong. But so my dad's grandparents, who I was really close to, and they really helped me with a lot of love and support. Mm-hmm. Sadly, they both passed away. My granddad had a heart attack, and my grandma later on, they said it was stomach cancer and could be caused from struggling so much with the loss of her husband. So I lost them at age 16, and they were really my new parents. my mum tried to get the custody over us, but it didn't really work out for her. She regretted a lot that she did, but I think we shouldn't really regret much. We just have to learn. We each do the thing. I still love my dad. I haven't seen my dad since I was 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And I asked him to meet up with me when I 3 years ago when I did a 100K run in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned it down. So it's really difficult for me. Yeah. I miss him, and I think I've missed that fatherly figure all my life.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. Like, we all have to acknowledge the pain, and I think paying the right amount of attention to grief is really valuable, but reliving the pain over and over again is no longer helpful, and we do have to move on and pay attention to the things that matter now. Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to change the way things unfolded, but reliving them again in your head isn't necessarily going to change anything. It's amazing that you've had such a turbulent youth, and yeah, you said you had that fighting spirit from quite an early age. Would that have always been a part of you, do you think?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I sometimes when I maybe have a little bit of a bad day or down day here, and especially after suffering trauma depression here in mm-hmm. New Zealand some years ago, I often think, when I was young, what got me through? Why do I still have that fighting instinct to life and to hope? And I was always amazed when I try and look back and trying to remember everything. It's sometimes I always feel, oh, well, how come could I forget some of the things? But I did a lot of things when I was young. So before my grandma died, I had decided to move away from home because I had realized that the environment was so toxic for me and I couldn't cope. And I got through school. My dad was really clever, but my mom and dad. So I survived that schooling well, even having lost a year. My classmates were amazing. And I decided to do a year of high school in the States. And I got a lovely family. And I got to run for the cross country team. And I had never really, as I said, run before. And I was the slowest runner to start with, and I ended up as the second fastest runner. Mm-hmm. And I've never run so much in my life, like six times a week. It was super structured, and interestingly enough, I had to eat so much food, and I couldn't believe, and I actually lost a lot of weight. And they said, oh, it's not very many exchange students we see losing weight in the States. And I remember, as I said, I didn't really felt I never had an eating disorder. It was more lack of the attention and love and which physical consequences they can have. So as I said, I see a lot of both men or girls or boys now either do a lot of exercise, so they maybe choose whether it's multi-sport or triathlon or ultra running as a excuse, maybe. Say having that as a goal to train a lot, but it could be underlying issues as well. But I just remember having to eat so much, and I just remember everybody at my school was like, oh my god, we don't have many people eating so much, but there was like half a liter ice cream a night. And but yeah, they were really amazing, and they were amazing friends I connected with over there that I later on went to the States and, you know, attended some of their weddings. I came home to Denmark, and actually I remember I ran 3,000 meter, but in shoes that are way too big, and I got a bronze medal. And I think his name was Wilson Kipketer. He was a Kenyan that is a Danish citizen that also won him a silver medals at the Olympics way back then for the 1500 meters. And I thought, oh my God, I never thought I was a runner. And I was super stoked to come home and have the national anthem and and be able to run to prove the doctors where I could actually fight back, to a better frame of mind, not give up hope, and fight at such a young age by myself to go overseas. And when I left for the States, my dad's partner said, I would never want to see you again. And I remember the words, but since that day I left that island, I was never to see my dad again.
Yeah, it felt like you really took the reins there. You took control of your life from that point onwards. And it's a pretty incredible decision to make. I feel like that could have been the make or break of you at that point, whether you conceded defeat or whether you took control of your own future. So it sounds like you chose to take control. Yeah, that's amazing. And when did adventure racing rear its head? Because that is not a sport that's been around for that long in a formalized way. When did you first get involved? What dragged you in?
So I can't quite remember. My mum can remember, because when I came back from the States, I chose to live with my mum. And we developed quite a good relationship. My mum was really more from a free-spirited person. Mm-hmm. So we maybe not the close mum and daughter relationship that maybe we had both hoped for, but a mutual respect. And my mum has always been amazing in respecting me in doing whatever I wanted to do, and always back me up. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's what you want to do? Sweet. And my mum ended up suffering from a depression as well for a year, and I managed to be there to support her. So I think my mom has been able to draw some inspiration both way, from us both being a bit of fighters and strong, and always have a hope that when we have it down, we will get back somehow, even though that maybe later on in life, in New Zealand as adults, I struggle maybe finding that fighting spirit, or I got a bit more scared of having that fighting spirit. But when I came back to my mum, I think that the running confidence, I said to my mum, I'm going to do marathon. And they were like, well, you're only 18. I was like, I don't care. I just do marathons. And I just did maybe this athletic training. I just went out running like crazy. And I said, I'm going to do a marathon in each city or each country. I just got these crazy ideas. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, I started mountain biking. I just do these 103 kilometers. And I never cared how long it took me. I was out there battling. And then I decided I'm going to do an Ironman, because I was always a little bit scared of water, because my brother, he got fear in the water, and I felt he tried to drown me. So I always have a bit of fear of water. So I did a diving course just in the swimming pool. But and then I thought, I'm going to do an Ironman. And because of my past with being much smaller and quite tiny, my mum is super tiny, and both my mum and dad quite fairly small people, or more skinnier people. I remember training for the Ironman, coming from a running background and training on the bike, and I just had these goals. I'm going to bike 100k today, and it didn't matter whether I could only bike 20k an hour or 25k an hour. I was just out there till I had completed it. So I had that enormous strength that I think my mum really admired, and could help her through the depression. And then I did all these other random things, whether I was doing a history course in Copenhagen. I just did all these crazy things, a dance course, I did a boxing course and gymnastic course. I always challenged myself that every time I got slightly better at something, I would choose a new discipline. I just always remained the running.
Yeah. And where was the drive coming from? It sounds like it's all just your own desire to do that. There was never someone you were trying to impress. There wasn't a coach who was putting pressure on you to do these things. There wasn't, you weren't trying to live up to your parents' sporting abilities because that wasn't proven. So yeah, it's just really coming from within, and I think that's quite sustainable. Because yeah, as you mentioned before, when you see someone who's out there doing crazy amounts of training, you do stop and wonder, are they just trying to take control of something? But it sounds like at least in your case, yeah, there could be the control from within, but that's sustainable, as opposed to it coming from somebody else, the pressure that somebody else is putting on you, which is, you see it quite a lot, I think, with some of the high performance stuff, certain schools as well that are really push high performance, and the pressure that these kids are under to perform and always be the best for everyone else and not for themselves. It's tough, but it sounds like you're really doing it for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think you made an excellent point there. I think I try to remind myself of that even now, even though I think when we get adults, sometimes we think we have to know everything or know our own actions and the reasons, but I do see maybe a lot we feel we have to live up to certain expectations, whether that is to win certain races, to be someone, mm-hmm. or to be more popular, or I think we see it with social medias, do we strive to have certain likes or to put up certain pictures? And I think, as some people might remember me, I did a few articles when I really went downhill later on in life because of a few things that happened. And it was extremely vulnerable, extremely scary and frightening, coming from such a fighting spirit as a child, because you can go either way. I think we often see, I know Michael Jordan or Oprah Winfrey, they come from extremely tough childhoods, but have these incredible stories about how they rise to fame, but still probably having a good heart. And I think I chose a lot of things when I was young. Like I also just said to my mum, I'm going traveling now for a year. And I remember I worked insanely hard at a hospital just doing basic jobs. But I would work 80 hours a week, still run, still have this enormous energy and try to, always had enormous passion for helping other people. And maybe trying to inspire other people, not intentionally, but showing if I can do it, you can do it. And I didn't have much money from my parents. I didn't have much from my dad, only that I always looked up to him in a way and wished he was there for me more. But it was a lot of fight, and I look back and think, yeah. Oh, I guess I'm lucky that I had that spirit to keep challenging myself. So, yeah, I traveled because I thought I was going to be a journalist. So I just wanted to live with the locals. And one friend traveled with me, and she said after a month, it was just too tough. She couldn't walk so much. I remember I walked everywhere with my backpack. And, you know, I spent 3 months in China learning the language and sleeping uncomfortable places. And I think I remember returning from those travels and my bike shop. That's how actually adventure racing came about more, because they said, oh, a girl has pulled out of this team, mm-hmm. Danish team that want to compete in Ireland. That was back in 2001. And how about you do it? Because you seem to have done so many different things. And I had heard about adventure racing because I watched Kathy Lynch, Nathan Farvey, mm-hmm. Steve Gurney, Jeff Mitchell, Neil Jones doing Eco Challenge. So I had been really captured by that. So I thought, oh, I don't know if I can do stuff like that. But so that ended up being my first adventure race in 2001. And we managed to get through in ninth place. And I was probably 39, 40 kilos back then. So I was quite proud of myself,
yeah.
Battling through.
Yeah, that's cool. And did you catch the bug from that point on? Was that like, wow, this is an incredible sport? Is that, yeah, just describe your feelings after that first race.
I think what really captured me was how well you have to work in a team to overcome the obstacles of, you know, I had to do things I'd never really tried before, kayaking, and we had some abseiling. The winning team was a family, Salomon spent for sponsored family. There was incredible fell runners back in the UK, and they did quite a few of the Saunter verses back in New Zealand, and I can't quite remember their name. I know Nathan Farway, Neil Jones will remember them, and they were just known for being so tough, just loving life, loving being on their feet. They won a lot of ultra running races, I think, in Europe as well. I think they all must have retired now. But I remember they said to me, see, if you love this sport, go to New Zealand. The Kiwis are world champions at this. They are liked, so tough. So I came home from Ireland. I said to my mom, I'm going to move to New Zealand. And that's what I did. So I looked up what degree I could do, which was an outdoor degree in outdoor education and adventure recreation. Mm-hmm. And then I made the plunge. So I moved to New Zealand in the 1st of January, 2002.
Wow. Okay, you've been here quite a long time then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been back to Europe often?
No, I went back in 2005 and I was able to sort of manage with studies that I would go back and I would work back in Denmark because I could earn quite good money and I was always a postie, so on the bike. It was a good job. And 2005, I did an adventure race in Sweden with another Danish team and it was called Explore Sweden, and that's how I met Elena Usher. We always had a bit of a laugh because people would always mix us up.
Oh, yeah.
And,
little blonde girl. Yeah. New Zealand.
And I know that was the year that she met Richard Usher as well. Mm-hmm. So that year I went home and I did Explore Sweden, which was a long, amazing race. It was so cold. We had to walk the kayak on the ice. Aaron Prince did that race. It was a lot of the retired people now from America that no longer races but maybe coaches. So it was fun. We did something called the Raid Series as well, and we did it in Sweden and Norway. So I remember 50k inline skating, and the Danes were just really good at that. And obviously, having lived here, it wasn't something I was maybe as natural at.
Yeah, definitely.
And then I went back in 2008 and raced with Neil Jones from New Zealand and two other Swedes. And we did a race in South Africa and later on did the World Champs in Brazil. So I worked back then as well. And I think that year I did a lot of mountain biking. I mountain biked with the club that a very famous Danish girl, Annika Langveld, is a member of as well, which she has just won Cape Epic. But I was really amazed how the clubs work in Denmark, whether it's orienteering or running or mountain biking, that they really help for a small member fee a year. You can go out training with the club for five times a week, and that is something I really miss in New Zealand.
Yeah, it seems a little bit more mixed up. People have their own little kind of private friend groups, but it might be really hard to find where those groups are if you just come into the scene from overseas. Certainly in Auckland, yeah, I find myself on the inside of a number of training groups, but I think it's invisible from the outside.
Yes, I mean, I think when I first moved to New Zealand and went and did the degree, luckily one of my teachers was Jean Corey Wright.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So I ended up babysitting her kids, who are now amazing orienteers, and she got me involved in Papo.
Yeah.
And that's how I met Sarah Prince and Laura Prince. Yeah. And those orienteers has always been really good to me. And also how I met John Howard, who is a Kiwi icon in the adventure racing. And I remember his name when he raced with Keith Murray and Andrew Murray. So I was in awe when I met John Howard, and he asked me to house sit for him. So I was house sitting for him, and then he said, when that was finished, he said, "Oh, I have this friend that's looking for a flatmate. He's won coast to coast a number of times. His name is Steve Gurney," and I was like, "Oh, okay, I can meet Steve." And he was at a orienteering race, and I met Steve, and I had no idea what coast to coast was. So I think it was quite hilarious for Steve to have a flatmate who had no idea what coast to coast was.
Yeah, and was that a really good experience for you, just sapping his energy and getting to see how he trains and take some tips for yourself?
Yeah, I think I learned a lot from John. I mean, obviously, John lives a very basic lifestyle, and I still meet him on occasion nowadays. He said his feet are a bit destroyed, but I see him surfing with the kids, and he still comes to orienteering races. And yeah, living with Gurney, I was probably amazed how much Steve put into the world of multisport. And maybe it's interesting to hear his story, how much he put into it, but maybe also the personal sacrifices it had. Yeah. You know, when you, I think Gurney said, you know, he used to train like 40 hours, and how that maybe sometimes can wreck you and wreck your balance of life with friends, relationships, different things. So it's really interesting how he changed that concept. And Steve, I think, later on in life has become a really close friend. In a sense, he helped me later on when I had a depression. And Steve did some things that I haven't seen many people do as a friend. When I had a big anxiety attack, and the things he did to help me through that, when his girlfriend was racing too, he didn't just follow her. He said, "You keep racing. I'm going to stay with Sia until she gets back on the bike."
Wow.
So I have huge respect for Steve being able to do that and help me through a difficult time as a friend. Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And as you said, someone who's made so many sacrifices before, and you might imagine that somebody like that would just stay on the train, stay on their own focused path, but that's pretty great to see someone make a personal sacrifice to help somebody else. What else got you more into adventure racing? So you obviously got good, and you referred to getting invited to some of these teams. What was the path you took to get from that first experience where you're fit and you've done well, but to be continually wanted by some of these top teams? What did your training look like?
I think I should probably mention the first few times I remember doing a 24-hour race here, and my teammates pulled out halfway through, which are really good friends as well. And I remember I just had that fighting instinct. I remember I had as a teenager and younger. Like, I was like, "I'm not gonna quit." Mm-hmm. And they said, "Oh, you joined the last team." So I joined the last team. And I remember I went through all them hallucinations, even though it's just a 24-hour team. It probably took us nearly a day and a half. And we just made the cutoff time. So I think the marshals were picking up the toilets from some of the transitions as we were coming in. And I remember the prize giving Seagate at the time, which was Christina Stroke Penny, or now Christina Anglem, Jeff Mitchell, Neil Jones, and Nathan Faraway. They had won the race, and obviously I'd looked up to them because I'd seen them do so well in these eco challenges and solo traverses on TV back from Denmark. So I started working at Billwack, and Jeff Mitchell from Seagate, went out for 9 years together. So my first introduction was, he said, "Do you want to help support crewing 2002 for the Solon Traverse?" And Christina had gotten quite sick after winning. They won the Eco Challenge Fiji. So Kathy Lynch was on the team, and I remember, oh no, I don't know if I feel quite good enough to meet all these legends of Kathy Lynch and Nathan Farvey and Neil Jones. I remember I was so nervous. I went to the transition and Jeff Dead, so Paul Crude, and I was like, I was just shaking when they were coming in, just like, oh, what do I do? And the Santaverse crew and media crew, they were so nice. And I remember after the race, they won that race, and Kathy was so friendly.
Yeah.
Nathan was extremely friendly. So they were really nurturing group to go into, even though I had actually no idea really what I was doing. But as I said, I had slowly been introduced to the orienteering club through Jean and Alistair Crowe Wright, and started doing a few more things. I didn't have a car the first year I stayed here, so I biked everywhere. And then people stole things on my bike at school. So I had a really low budget. So, but again, I had the spirit that just entering these races, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't care if I came last. When Jeff and I got together, Lynn, he helped me a bit. Obviously, he competed quite well. He never quite won Coast to Coast. Taken was his best place, and he did quite well in Kepler. I think his best time was 4:57, and I was really amazed with the sort of training that would go. Was some of his story was biking from here to Mangkok, climb Mangkok and bike back, bike to Heafy, run Heafy each way, bike back. So extremely tough, and I was like, oh my God, these Kiwis, I don't know if I can be this tough. They just seem to know everything. Like, and some of the trips we went hiking, he would just push me up, because obviously he was still racing. Was the last year with Seagate, and then he went on to race with Neil and Ian Edmund with an American, Robin Benincasa. So I learned a lot. Nathan helped me to go to Lake Tahoe with Seagate for 6 weeks. So I was support crew with Jody Farvey and Nat Anglem. So I have a really close relationship to especially Nat and Christina, which turned out to be very valuable later on when I hit quite a bad depression. So Jeff helped me a lot of things. The first multisport I entered was not Coast to Coast. I sort of felt Coast to Coast wasn't really my race. Maybe I was looking for a different challenge. So my first race was Mangkok to Christchurch in 2003.
Did they still do this race?
No, it was last year in 2007.
Okay.
It was, I think most people thought it was too hard. The first year I entered 2003, I think it was 12 individual men. It was Tim Pearson, Steve Gurney, John DeCopy, who was one Coast to Coast as well, okay. Australian multi-sport adventure racing legend. And I felt quite proud, because I remember he said, he obviously knew Jeff, and he said, oh, is your girlfriend Elena? And I just like, oh, no, maybe he wish, but I think... I always said, oh, thanks for the compliment, because I always look up to Lena a little bit. And I think Lena, since that time, we always joked that she's my big sister and I'm the little sister. So that was quite nice. But so I remember doing, Mangkok to Christchurch. I'd just gotten my grade 2 certificate. So, and we had to paddle the lower Rangitata, which some say is grade 2, grade plus, maybe at the top section. And my competitor for the female was Jill Westerner. And I was pretty much totally last on each day. There was a lot of teams that I didn't know. But Sarah was racing in a team. There was a lot of people that raced in a team that have come through the ranking. I think Joe Williams. So a lot of times back then, I was obviously a lot of faces that didn't rate individual. But... And then the year after, I thought, I'm going to have to do this again. And I think that year, 3 weeks later, I did Gold Rush as well. So I would just have this fighting spirit from young that I would just enter. I didn't really care how I do because it was so new. Mark Elliott became my coach because I used to do Monday night sessions with Mark Elliott and John Hellemans. John got me on their tri team because obviously I didn't have much money, so I didn't know how to kayak. So he said, oh, you can swim. And so I was on the swim squad, and I remember swimming on the slowest lane. And in the fast lane, we had Andrew Hewitt, Chris Gimmel, and all these amazing athletes. So I've known Andrew for a long time, and they've always been incredibly friendly. I remember I broke my foot once and showed up to swimming, and John was like, why are you swimming so funny? I was like, well, I broke, I made a tarsal in my foot doing something silly. And yeah, again, they were just so incredible, nice. And I was really grateful that I maintained that thing, that I was doing it for fun and passion. And Jeff obviously helped me to get a little bit better, but I always maybe did a lot of things on my own with a lot of hardship. Hindsight, maybe you could have done differently, but I think I did a lot with not much, just relying on having good people around me.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. And the attitude of just entering races and just having so many races on the calendar, from one perspective, seems really daunting, because the way most of us treat races is with a lot of pressure. But I think the more races you do, the less pressure that you put on them. You realize that they're all just races and it's all just part of the bigger journey. And so there are two approaches to that. Yeah, one is to just keep racing all the time and not care about any specific race. Just do them all, and I think in the long run, you'll have incredible performances. Or to kind of do no races, which is almost what I prefer at the moment, because I do get trapped into that mindset of taking some races quite seriously, and then you spend the whole week beforehand nervous about it, and then you can barely eat breakfast because you're so nervous. And then if you have a really bad performance, it's a bit of a disaster because you became very emotionally attached to that race and to the potential of a good performance. So yeah, I really enjoy the consistency of just training, and if there is a race, just treating it like part of the bigger picture of training. It definitely works better now, and it sounds like that came quite naturally to you. There weren't any big experiences of massive disappointment in races. It's just all a mission and all part of the bigger picture. Is that how you'd describe it?
Yeah, especially for the first few years, I will say, obviously, I was probably, obviously, amazed or hats off to a lot of Kiwis who put so much effort into the multisport, especially a race like Coast to Coast. How much sacrifice in training they do. And I think back then, maybe I could have done better. I always worked really hard with school. So I've never maybe had the opportunity to train full time for something to see what potential I could have. And maybe some of the other obstacles I had later on, when Jeff and I separated, obviously I came in a really bad bad state, and the help of a lot of multisporter, I know some people can remember 2012 longest day, when I had such a massive anxiety attack. I remember
in the race
and I remember Saki Mayor, I remember a few multisporters, they said, we will help you through this year, we can piggyback you. And I remember getting the phone call from Christina Englund the following day, and I just remember she said, Sia, I know what you're going through. I've been through the exact same thing. I think I know what help you need. And I think I can see how tough life has been for you the last year, and you have to ask for help. And I think I remember saying to Nat, I'm not sick. And Nat said to me, Sia, you're not well, but we can fix this, and we want to help you. for our own kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was amazing. And I want to include a few more people with this JKK or Jan Kees Koopmanstein. He's helped me tremendous, not only trying to help me become a better paddler, but he was with me down some paddling down the gorge. And I remember Nathan and Sophie was with us one time as well. And I always looked up to, you know, incredible talent of Sophie and how strong she is with her attitude. Mm-hmm. And she just excelled at everything she put her mind to. But I think I had a bit of a tough time, and Jan Kees just know how to manage that. And he said, Sophie, you two just paddle ahead. I'll just stay with Sia. She just needs people around her, because Ned said to me, don't ever stop racing Sia.
Mm-hmm.
But if people say to you, why didn't you do so well? Just don't believe those people, or explain to them, say, I'm suffering from depression. Sometimes my mind tells me something different.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to sit down or slow down or take a breather, and I come back. And who passes me, or if I'm passing something, it doesn't matter at all. I'm just here because I want to be part of the racing. I want to be part of the community. And I'm not going to give in to depression that is going to stop me from doing or being involved in something I enjoy. So I did a few things for years that maybe people look back, oh my God, see, you must have been so terrible. But the struggle, and as I said, Gurney will remember a few of the struggles from the race, the Mototapo,
mm-hmm.
Avalanche Peak, but I really have a lot of admiration for those people that understood, and some inspiring role models we have in our sport.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, coming back to the Mankuk to Christ race, I always saw it as a journey, maybe for my multi-sport, because I did it every year and I raced some amazing athletes. Then 2003, I raced Christina and I got a little bit better, but they changed the course to much longer. And I remember my support crew at the stage was Rachel Smith, another really amazing orienteer.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to Mike Elliott, I just had so much cramp. It was just, you know, building upon doing your first multi-sport race, which is, ended up being 31 hours. And I'd never done anything like that. So it was quite a hard battle. And I remember, Christina, that in a year I got a little bit better. I'd been a little bit more confident in the kayak. But Christina waited for me each day. She stayed up probably waiting 2-3 hours for me to finish. She didn't just go to bed recovering herself
mm-hmm.
for the next day, because she was racing for money and they had a 10% rule. So it meant that I came second that year but didn't get any money. And Christina was a little bit against that, because she knew at that time I didn't have much money. I had to pay $17,000 a year to be an exchange student at Polytech for the degree. I think, obviously, I had met Jeff, so I did have we did share a car, but I didn't have my driver license, so I had to. So she actually picked me up after I finished the race in 2003. I think I was hobbling to the finish line because, I don't know, it was just such a long race. I think Richard Asher, I think Marcel Hackner remember that year, because they put an abseil in. It was just extreme. But Christina picked me up after the race. She got me some Arnica. She said, I take this. She put me in an Epsom salt bath. So I really have a lot of admiration just for that kindness and sharing your experience. And then the last time I did Mankuk to Christ was 2007, and Elena raced, and we ended up being separated by 5 minutes. And I always remember that's one of my highlights of racing, because you could just see the journey, how long it takes to get good at something and persevering with not much money, not the highest quality the bike. I remember I think I had borrowed some wheels, and Elena said, oh, I have Richard Usher's fancy zip wheels. And I remember passing her on the road bike on day two, and I was like, oh my God, I'm passing Elena. Maybe I'm dreaming. And Elena was just so encouraging. It was quite amazing. And I remember shaking, getting into the transition. I was like, oh, what do I do now? And Richard and Jeff were like, get your back on, you know, helping both of us. And I really have a lot of admiration for Elena. And on day three, I remember on the mountain bike, she kept looking back and she was like, she stopped at the end of the mountain bike. She said, I can't shake you. I have to, you know, give you a thumbs up for persevering. And we ended up finishing the last day together. Yeah. And so I have a lot of, admiration for Elena as well. And as a friend, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. And you do make really strong connections when someone else can see inside the struggles, but you also mentioned those who sometimes can't see what's going on the inside of the circle, and perhaps they do pass judgment a little bit because all they've seen is the results. Would you even question that definition of success if people are looking at the results to determine whether you have had a successful time or not?
I think generally I've learned we have to be really careful about making statements, because they can come across maybe as judging, you know, why didn't they do so well? And I think maybe we forget to maybe often ask what was going on. And I think if you can see a pattern, and as I said, this is why I have huge admiration for Christina, mm-hmm. to notice that I was really struggling. It was such a massive thing for me to drag myself to the start line, knowing how scared I was, the demons I was fighting, getting on that bike, running from the beach, and things getting out of control, not being able to go home to a family, mm-hmm. into a safe house. Sarah Prince, who will be my best friend in mm-hmm. New Zealand, I always trust her. Mm-hmm. Maybe she's Swedish, so I know she always tells me the truth, whether it's harsh or not, but I know she does it because she really cares. Yeah. And sometimes she said, see, you're not happy. I can tell we need to fix it. And sometimes mm-hmm. I think I maybe have adapted a little bit of an attitude that I've seen a little bit in New Zealand, and maybe it's one of the things that I know Kiwis are so tough. I've seen them, as we talked about, athletes, they're incredible tough. Maybe I've also raised the Gotong also with the rugby people, but I think we have to learn that being tough is also being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And being weak doesn't matter that we can't succeed. And I think it's really important, because I see a lot of people, particularly multi-sporters, you see it after Coast to Coast particularly, because it's a race that people see a lot of emphasis on, or maybe God's own, that when you don't do well, we feel we have to almost make excuses why people didn't do well. We have to rectify, we have to write a big story why our race didn't go well, because maybe friends won't like us, maybe the media won't like us, maybe Facebook won't like us, maybe our friends won't like us, mm-hmm. but I think we forget that people will like us if they like us for who we are. And I'm not sure whether it's the more modern society, or it's really just come from the pressure we put ourselves that, well, why do we have to win this race, really? Like, who has to win this race? You know, and I think I've learned for a few people that I think has the healthiest attitude towards winning, and one of them will be Chris Vaughan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I think he's just, I don't know, that I think he deserves an award. I'm not sure whether it's a kindness award, or I just think he just has so many qualities. I think so many people could learn from. He never I've never seen him really write a report about anything.
No. And he does it all so simply. It's all very intuitive to him. That's just the way he rolls. And to all those who are overthinking things, to come across Chris Vaughan and just to realize that how simple his kind of mind operates around these things and how much of a good time he's having, it just throws this, it throws the ideas that some people have about taking every detail with a fine-tooth comb in some of these races, and kind of throws that idea out, because he's just so relaxed and so focused on, I think, the just the process of racing and tackling all the problems as they come.
Yes.
It's definitely, he's definitely shaped my views a little bit, because we've been racing an orienteering head-to-head for quite a while, and when he has a good race, he's happy. When I have a good race, I'm happy. And when he has a bad race, he's still happy.
Yes, exactly. And yeah.
When I used to have a bad race, I would be emotionally broken.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that contrast there was something obvious, and I'm busy paying attention to all the details of what went wrong and how can we prevent this. And eventually I realized, well, I'm not actually getting any better.
No.
Despite the fact I'm trying to get better, and I'm still having a bad time on bad races, and maybe I should just be more like Chris and just take them all as either a good win or a funny funny mistake.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I think I just embrace life and being in the present. And I think I think you could draw similarity to him. And I think even Killian, Jornet, I think they both come from just how they view life. Oh, this sounds like a cool challenge. Okay, off we go. And obviously together with Emily, I think they are extremely inspiring. Yeah, as you say, just how they still live simply. And I had the privilege of racing the first Gotthorn with Stuart Lynch and Ian Inburn as well. And they are two athletes that are just really simple too, who I never see make any big hoo-ha if they've done well. Being multiple world champion, champion in so many multi-sport races. But they're like, oh, well, that was great. It was awesome teamwork, you know. And then just carry on, and their love for their friends and surroundings, and the, what I've learned from them and their opportunity to have in race with them has been really nourishing and caring, really caring people, I think.
Yeah. No, really. Wow, that's been an incredible delve into what it all looks like from your perspective. I'm getting mindful of your time because you've got a race this afternoon, so you've got to get yourself packed and psyched up. Shorter race today, but that's great to see that in line with what you're saying, just taking on all races, not just all long races, but you're doing some shorter running stuff as well, and just every opportunity to push yourself and be part of the community is fair game for your race calendar, it seems.
Yes, I think last time I did the cross country series, I think was 2011, 2012. So I run with Marty Lukes, and I coach a bit with Lisa Bricknell as well. So Chris Donnell, and they talked about the cross country series. So I thought, oh, okay, it's 8 years ago since I did it. I'll try again and be part of a community again and a team. And we're today it's 4K's flat, so not suited to me at all, but it would be fun putting on a club t-shirt and run in a team with girls over 40 and just have a bit of fun and see the kids race, and I think just have a good day out and start off more autumn.
Yeah, sweet. Good luck. And thank you so much for sharing your story. And I'm sure all the listeners will be equally appreciative and mesmerized by what you've had to share. So thanks, Sia.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
If you're enjoying the Perfect Flow podcast, and want more value from it in the future, there are some ways you can support it. The first is to rate or leave a positive review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or other platforms where it's available. The second is to share this podcast or specific episodes on social media or with friends. The third is to get involved more directly through the Perfect Flow page on Facebook, where I'm trying to construct a more interactive community. I want Perfect Flow to belong to the listeners, and if you tell me what topics you're most interested in, or even suggest specific guests, I'll do my best to make it happen. This is your opportunity to be part of something that answers your questions and adds value to your life. Another good reason to follow Perfect Flow on Facebook is that I post links to episodes, blog posts, and anything I find useful to this page. It's a great way to follow my training, racing, and learning. Another great way to stay engaged is to subscribe to genebeverage.nz. This way you will get podcasts and blogs emailed to you, avoiding the clutter of Facebook. I don't know where this project will take us, but the reception so far has been positive. Who knows where we might be in a few years?